You know, when we watch a sci-fi movie, the artificial intelligence is it's always this glowing, pulsating brain. It speaks in riddles, it has a personality, and it feels like it's actually thinking in the exact same way you and I do.
Right, yeah. We like to imagine a ghost in the machine, a conscious entity, pondering the universe, making decisions based on intuition.
Exactly. But then you walk into a real machine learning lab, you look at what's actually on the screens, and that glowing brain just it disappears. You aren't looking at thoughts. You're looking at something much more rigid.
You're looking at grids, giant, perfectly organized grids of numbers being processed at incomprehensible speeds. I mean, there is no intuition, just massive structural architecture.
Yeah, and if you're joining us for this deep dive, your mission today is to decode the secret language of practical machine learning. Because the truth is, AI algorithms aren't casting spells. They're just doing extremely fast math on these massive data grids. So we're going to learn how to read those grids, skipping the dense jargon and focusing purely on the practical mechanisms. We really want to understand the why and the how behind the math.
Which is so important because understanding these simple structural foundations is the absolute key to unlocking how algorithms actually see the world. If you want to know how an AI recognizes a face or predicts a stock price or generates a painting, you have to start with the rules of the grid.
Okay, let's unpack this. We are starting with the foundational building block of linear algebra, which is the matrix. A matrix is basically a rectangular array of numbers arranged in rows and columns.
Right.
It's typically denoted by a bold capital letter, like a big bold A. And if I'm looking at this practically, a matrix seems to be, well, the ultimate stripped-down Excel spreadsheet, just raw data sitting in a grid.
Yeah, the spreadsheet analogy works for the visual layout, but here's where an Excel sheet fails to capture what a matrix really is in practice.
Oh, how so?
Well, in Excel, you can move columns around, color code things, or leave cells blank. A matrix is entirely unyielding. No formatting, no fancy headers, just raw numbers arranged in a very specific mathematically binding order.
And that order is governed by universal naming convention, right? Inside that big matrix A, you have individual elements, the specific numbers in the grid. We denote those with a lowercase letter and a subscript, like A sub ij.
Yes, exactly.
Which brings us to the golden rule of matrices, that subscript always, always reads row, then column. So A sub 1, 2 is row 1, column 2. But I have to push back here for a second.
Sure, go ahead.
Why are we so obsessed with the strict row, then column rule? Is it just math snobbery? Like, who cares if I say column 2, row 1 instead? Does it really matter?
It is definitely not snobbery. It's about operational survival in practical machine learning. Think of it as the universal grammar of data.
Operational survival. That sounds intense.
I mean, it is. In a massive ML project, you might have teams in different countries writing different parts of the algorithm, or you might be running operations across, thousands of distributed servers.
Right.
If your piece of the code flips a row and a column because you didn't follow the convention, the data structures misalign. The entire algorithm crashes because the math physically cannot compute.
Wow. Okay. So it's the load-bearing wall of the whole operation. You don't mess with it. And that dictates the dimensions of the matrix. We describe the overall size of this grid by its row count and column count, written as n by k n rows, k columns.
Yeah, and the shape tells you a lot about the data inside. If the number of rows equals the number of columns, so n equals k, you have a square matrix.
Makes sense.
If you only have one row, so n is one, it's a row vector. And if you only have one column, so k is one, it's a column vector.
So the strict grammar keeps the machine from tearing itself apart. But what happens when that grid scales up? When we aren't just looking at 10 rows, but like 10 million?
That's where raw calculation becomes a physical problem. Processing millions of data points requires massive amounts of computing power, time, electricity.
Right, server farms just humming.
Exactly. If the computer has to manually calculate every single interaction in a giant grid, the system crawls to a halt.
Here's where it gets really interesting. Once you understand the basic grid, you start noticing that certain shapes and patterns naturally emerge in statistics and machine learning. Recognizing these special matrix types isn't just a neat math trick, right?
No, not at all.
These are basically computational cheat codes.
They are the ultimate shortcuts. If a matrix falls into one of these special structural categories, the computer knows it can use alternative mathematical methods to save massive amounts of algebra.
Okay, let's run through the mechanics of these cheat codes. First up is the symmetric matrix. A matrix is symmetric if it equals its own transpose, meaning if you flip it diagonally, The numbers mirror each other perfectly. The element in row 1, column 2 is exactly the same as the element in row 2, column 1.
What's fascinating here is what that mirroring represents in the real world. Covariance matrices and kernel matrices are always symmetric.
Why is that?
Because relationships in those contexts are perfectly mirrored. If you are measuring the distance or the correlation between feature A and feature B, the mathematical distance is exactly the same as between feature B and feature A. It's a two-way street.
That makes intuitive sense. But the deep dive materials highlight a specific mathematical property here. Symmetric matrices are diagonalizable with real eigenvalues. And we need to hit pause right there.
Oh, yeah. I know where you're going with this.
Diagonalizable with real eigenvalues sounds like the exact kind of dense jargon we promised to avoid at the top of the show. What does that actually mean for the algorithm?
Fair point. Let's break that down. Think of an eigenvalue as the primary backbone of a shape. If you have a massive chaotic cloud of data points, say thousands of measurements about housing prices, that cloud is going to stretch in a specific direction.
Okay, I'm picturing a stretched out cloud.
Right. The eigenvalue is the math's way of finding that exact direction of the stretch.
So it's finding the primary trend hidden in all the noise.
Exactly. In practical ML, this is the core engine behind principal component analysis, or PCA. Because the matrix is perfectly mirrored and symmetric, the algorithm can confidently find the real-world trends, those primary directions of the data, without getting lost in abstract, imaginary numbers.
That's brilliant.
Yeah, it compresses the data while keeping the most important information intact.
But what if the data isn't perfectly mirrored? What if we want to isolate specific variables without them interfering with each other? That brings us to the diagonal matrix. This is a square matrix where the only non-zero numbers are sitting right on the main diagonal from the top left to the bottom right.
And every other number in the entire grid is a zero.
Right.
Oh, computers adore zeros. If you have a 1,000 by 1,000 matrix, that is a million data points. If it's a diagonal matrix, only 1,000 of those points have actual values.
Wow, so the computer can completely skip the other 999,000 calculations.
It's an incredible boost to efficiency because multiplying anything by zero just makes it disappear.
Let's walk through the mechanics of that. A major application for this is 3D Gaussian splatting, which uses diagonal scale matrices. How does a diagonal sea of zeros actually help render a 3D object?
It creates an environment of isolated variables. A diagonal matrix represents independent scaling along each coordinate axis. Imagine you are adjusting the properties of a 3D object in a simulation.
Okay.
The math requires multiplying the object's current coordinates by your scale matrix. Because the matrix is diagonal, the x-axis value is multiplied by a real number, but its interactions with the y and z-axis are multiplied by zero.
So the changes can't bleed over.
Precisely. You can stretch the object along the x-axis, making it wider, without accidentally warping its height on the y-axis or its depth on the z-axis. The zeros act as a firewall, keeping the variables completely independent.
Now, if all the numbers on that diagonal are the exact same value, say they're all the number 5, that's called a scalar matrix. It scales all directions equally, it just blows the whole 3D object up or shrinks it down uniformly without changing its proportions.
And that leads us to the most famous scalar matrix of them all, the identity matrix, usually denoted by a capital I. This is a diagonal matrix where every number on the diagonal is exactly a 1.
The structural anchor. It's the multiplicative identity, which basically means if you multiply any matrix by the identity matrix, nothing changes.
Right. It's the matrix equivalent of multiplying a regular number by 1. 5 times 1 is still 5. Matrix A times matrix third is still matrix A.
And its counterpart is the zero matrix, or null matrix, where every single element is a zero. That's the additive identity. Matrix A plus the zero matrix is just matrix A.
Yeah, in the complex world of algorithm design, the identity and zero matrices act as your baseline reference points. When the math gets incredibly complex, these matrices keep the equations grounded.
We have one more special shape to cover before we zoom in. What about when we are dealing with massive, interconnected, probabilistic models, where we can't just rely on a neat diagonal line of numbers? We have triangular matrices. There is the lower triangular, where everything above the diagonal is a zero, and the upper triangular, where everything below the diagonal is a zero. These are essential for techniques called LU decomposition and Kolesky factorization.
Those terms definitely sound like heavy machinery.
They really do.
But the mechanism behind them is quite elegant. LU decomposition and Kolesky factorization are essentially methods for breaking down a wildly complex, dense square matrix into two simpler triangular parts.
Right, but why bother breaking it down? Why not just have the computer solve the square?
Because a dense square matrix full of interlocking variables is a simultaneous equation nightmare. The computer has to juggle everything at once, but by factoring it into a lower triangle and an upper triangle, half of each new matrix becomes zeros.
Oh, I see.
You create a step-by-step cascade. You can solve for the first variable easily, plug that into the second row to solve the second variable, and so on. It turns an overwhelming simultaneous calculation into a simple sequential breeze. It's how algorithms process huge covariance models without melting down the servers.
We've looked at the massive grids, and we've found the computational cheat codes hiding in their shapes. Now let's zoom all the way in. We're going to the atomic level of the data grid.
The vector. A vector is just a matrix with exactly one row or exactly one column.
True.
But there is a crucial non-negotiable rule here. Unless stated otherwise, a vector is always assumed to be a column vector. An n by 1 matrix, standing straight up.
Yes, if you see a vector written horizontally, a row vector, it is explicitly the transpose of the column vector. The column is the default state of being.
Let's ground this with an analogy for you listening. Imagine a patient's medical file at a hospital. They just ran 10 different blood tests. You can think of that patient's results as a column vector. It's a single vertical list of 10 numbers.
Sounds simple enough. Now, here's where my brain hits a wall. The framework of linear algebra states that vectors carry geometric meaning. You can think of that vertical list of numbers as a point in an n-dimensional space, or as an arrow pointing from the origin to that point. How does an algorithm look at a list of 10 cholesterol and blood sugar numbers and see a geometric arrow?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, you've just hit on the entire foundation of machine learning. The algorithm doesn't see a medical chart. It sees coordinates.
Coordinates, like on a map.
Exactly. Let's start simple. If there were only two blood tests, you could easily draw a graph with an X and Y axis, right? That's a 2D space. The two test results tell you exactly where to put the dot on the graph. If there were three tests, you'd have a 3D space with X, Y, and Z axes.
Okay, I'm with you so far. I can visualize a dot hovering in a 3D room.
10 blood tests simply means a 10-dimensional geometric space. We physically can't picture a 10-dimensional space in our human brains, but to a computer, the math scales up perfectly. Those 10 test results are the exact coordinates for a single specific point in that massive space.
That's crazy to think about.
And the vector is the mathematical arrow pointing directly from the center of the space to that patient's exact location. By translating biological data into these geometric arrows, the machine learning model can do something incredible. It can calculate the Euclidean distance between them.
So if my arrow and your arrow are pointing to the exact same cluster in this 10-dimensional space, the algorithm says, hey, these two patients are highly similar.
It finds similarities, it groups them into clusters, or it detects anomalies. If a new patient's arrow points way off into a dark corner of the 10-dimensional space where no healthy patient has ever been, the algorithm flags it as a massive anomaly. That is how predictive algorithms actually work. They turn mundane lists of human traits into physical geometric distances.
That is wild. It's literally turning biology or finance or human language into pure geometry. But if these data points are floating around as millions of arrows in massive n-dimensional spaces, the algorithm is completely blind unless it has a coordinate map to find them. How do we write the code to grab a specific arrow out of the giant matrix?
That's where indexing comes in. If you want your algorithm to navigate the grid without getting hopelessly lost, you need strict, consistent notation to pull the data.
Let's look at the rules for pulling specific columns or rows out of our big matrix A. I want a specific column, say column K. The notation is a lowercase bold a with a subscript of a dot, then K, or sometimes just A sub K. That denotes column K as a column vector.
Right. And if you want a specific row, say row I, the notation is lowercase bold a subscript I, then a dot, or more commonly, a sub I prime. Notice that prime symbol, the little tick mark. That denotes the transpose.
Meaning you took the horizontal row from the grid and you stood it up to be a vertical column. But wait, why go through the trouble? If the patient is sitting in a horizontal row in the master database, why do we have to stand them up straight into a vertical column vector before we analyze them?
Because of the mechanical rules of matrix multiplication, think of it like a lock and a key. When you multiply two matrices together, the inner dimensions must perfectly align. The number of columns in the first matrix must match the number of rows in the second matrix.
So you can't just smash two rows together.
It's impossible. If you try to multiply a horizontal row by another horizontal row, the teeth of the key don't align with the cumblers of the lock. The math physically cannot be computed. Because our models are built to multiply data by a set of column weights, pulling a row out of the spreadsheet means you must transpose it into a column before the algorithm runs. Otherwise, the dimensions crash.
So what does this all mean for the classic data matrix? We have a very specific convention that you will see everywhere in econometric and ML notation, X sub I. When we write X sub I, we mean the ith observation as a column vector.
Yes. In a standard data matrix, usually a big capital X, each row is an observation. Row 1 is patient 1, row 2 is patient 2. The columns are the different tests.
Okay, got it.
So if you want to look at patient number 5, you go to row 5. But to feed patient 5 into your mathematical model, you pull that row out, transpose it into a vertical column to satisfy the lock and key rules, and call it X sub 5.
It's like having a master address book. The big matrix X is the whole crowd of people sitting in rows in a stadium. The notation X sub I is the universal shorthand for pulling one specific person out of their row, standing them up straight, and putting them under the algorithm's microscope.
Knowing this specific subscript notation is the key to reading ML research papers without getting completely lost. It eliminates massive ambiguity. In practical ML code, forgetting to stand the person up straight is the fastest way to break your matrix multiplications. The dimensions won't align and the entire system fails.
It all comes back to the grid, the strict, unyielding rules of the grid. Okay, let's recap this deep dive for you because we covered the real hidden architecture of AI today. Matrices aren't just boxes of numbers. They are the fundamental data grids governed by strict row-then-column dimensions.
Yes, exactly.
Special shapes, like symmetric and diagonal matrices, aren't just trivia. They are the computational cheat codes that isolate variables and let complex models run without melting down our servers.
And at the atomic level, vectors turn mundane lists of data into geometric points in an n-dimensional space. That geometry is the mechanism algorithms use to compare, contrast, and predict.
Right.
And finally, standard indexing conventions, like the ubiquitous X sub I, allow us to reliably pluck individual observations out of the massive grid and feed them into the geometric engine.
The next time you use an AI tool, whether you are asking a chatbot a complex question, or using a photo filter, or looking at a recommended movie, remember that it's not actually thinking in words or images. It is building and navigating vast geometric spaces made entirely of vectors and matrices.
Yeah, the glowing conscious brain is an illusion. The reality is a magnificent, lightning-fast architecture of linear algebra.
It's taking your prompt, turning it into an arrow, and calculating exactly where it points in a billion-dimensional grid. Which leaves you with a final thought to mull over. If a machine learning algorithm turns every single observation into a vector, a geometric arrow pointing somewhere in space, what does the vector of your daily digital footprint look like? Every click, every search, every location ping, stabbed in a single vertical column. What exact shape are you forming right now in the algorithm's matrix? Something to think about. Until next time.